Dear ladies, dear gentlemen, thank you for this warm welcome from us and for the opportunity to enjoy the spirit of Frankfurt's critical theory again, which I missed now for a couple of years in Bremen. And I have to admit that I felt a little bit flattered so to have been asked to give this keynote address tonight. But so I will try to hide this trace of self-satisfaction behind the mask of seriousness. And this is necessary, I think, because the topic I'm going to talk about is not a very festive one. It's a critique of the law of world society, a critical examination of the contribution of legal form to suffering, racism, post-colonialism, austerity policy, military conflicts, and worldwide hunger. Because of these entanglements of law with social misery, the relationship between radical social criticism and law has always been a very complicated one. Law can, in certain circumstances, serve as a bastion of subalterns, as Antonio Gramsci puts it, but law also masks existing relations of power and domination in society. All too often, law is a camouflage for brutalities and a rule of law, a rule of legal violence. In his poem Ajax, for example, which refers to a tragedy by Sophocles, to which I would like to return at greater length later, Heiner Müller gets to the heart of this critique of legal violence, and he describes Ajax, with whom Heiner Müller identifies, as a victim of this legal violence. Law causes Ajax misfortune and Ajax commits suicide. So I have a painting here. It's a vase of the Greek vase painter and potter Exekias, 530 before Christ. And Ajax here is just depositing his weapons before he kills himself. A mixture of legal violence and oblivion, according to Heiner Müller, is responsible for Ajax's looming disaster. And Müller wants to show with his poem that this legal violence kills people. This is his accusation, I quote from this poem. In the hotel in Berlin, capital city of unreality, my gaze falls from the window onto the Mercedes star above the Europa Center, turning melancholically in the night sky, over the dappled gold of Auschwitz and other branches of the Deutsche Bank. Müller's point is that state authority as Staats- und Rechtsgewalt, as legal violence, does not proceed from the people as the pseudo-rationalistic account of modern constitutions would have it, but legal violence is also a product of the economic system. Law is part of political economic violences. No capitalism without law. No means of production without legal property. No productive forces without employment contracts. No military police intervention policy without the cloak of law and the mantle of oblivion. How, this is Müller's question, is democratic law possible after Auschwitz? How can one think of the corporate social responsibility of transnational companies without taking into account the line leading from colonialism to imperialism, neo-colonialism, transnationality? Müller's poem exposes the force of law. How can a Deutsche Bank AG boast in its annual reports that it complies with the human rights provisions of the Global Compact, while at the same time being involved in injustice worldwide, being jointly responsible for reckless speculation in foodstuffs that is driving food prices up and people into ruin, and responsible for a global financial crisis that is plunging people into despair? If law is not even able to recognize that human rights are generating into merchandising instruments in the practice of the global players, then it should at least be able to develop a sense of disgust with itself. I will take these criticisms, these critiques of the entanglement of law with violence as a point of departure for exploring the possibility of a tertium of law beyond pseudo-rationality and violence. I choose this approach to overcome the dichotomous basic assumptions that sea law is always oscillating between an apology for violence and a utopia for reason. I will in the following therefore analyze the possibility of this legal terzum, a legal force beyond legal violence and legal reason. Thus force is at the center of my considerations, and to put it more precise, I examine the potential of an aesthetic reflection on the force of law to overcome the violence of law. I want to sketch this normative program with recourse to the authors of the first generation of critical theory, with particular reference to Theodor Adorno and Walter Benjamin. Normative theories of law feature centrally in the Frankfurt School, at last, since the work of Jürgen Habermas and Ingeborg Bauer in the second generation of Frankfurt School critical theory. In its third generation, legal theory has also developed to a central area of research outside the law department. This finds expression in Axel Honneth's Hegelian philosophy of law, by a force principle of justification decisively shaped by Rawls in liberalism, how the Bunkhorst combination of systems and discourse theories of law, Sonja Buckel's theory of law inspired by materialism, and Christoph Menke's aesthetic theory of law. All these approaches integrate the work of the first generation of Frankfurt School critical theory more or less clearly into their conception. And even Jacques Derrida and his post-structuralist critique of law first develops its subversive force in connection with Walter Benjamin's critique of violence. I will try to render these first generation critiques fruitful for a theory of the law of world society beyond legal violence and legal reason. And I will sketch four necessary steps for a radical critique of law in world society. And here comes my first step. It's the dissociation of legal violence and state violence. Critique of law must be more than critique of the state, and only if we abandon the identification of critique of law with critique of the state, if we dissociate law and state, we can analyze the complex entanglements of law with social violences. Law is classically conceived, especially in political theory, as a product of political communities. Within the organization of the state, law partakes of political violence. Law, on Otto Kirchheimer's conception, guarantees the continued existence of an existing state system as a system of domination. It obscures, this was Franz Neumann's point, the rule of the bourgeoisie in the state, because the invocation of the rule of law makes it unnecessary to name the real rulers in society. And for Eugen Pashukanis, the unity of law and the state creates, I quote, the field of application and object of violence. Therefore, critical approaches ranging from Hermann Cohen and his Marburg neo-Kantianism to Franz Rosenzweig have taken the functional synthesis of the state and law as their point of departure and criticized legal violence as part of state violence. From this perspective, the circle of legal violence can be broken by overcoming state violence. On these readings, a law that does without the state can found an era free of legal violence. Recent approaches draw on with these criticisms of the identification of law and the state and insist that the transnationalization of law in particular is creating new opportunities for social law beyond the state, whose jurist generative force is situated in world society itself. Jacques Derrida, for example, sees it as the responsibility of intellectuals to do everything possible to change the existing state of the law, to invent new rights. Derrida conceives of this requirement as a, I quote, transnational, not just a cosmopolitan demand, because, as he writes, the cosmopolitan still presupposes the categories of the state and the citizen, even if the citizen is a world citizen. Therefore, Derrida understands the unleashing of the subversive way of operating of the social force of law as an expression of global solidarity and humanity. Derrida hopes that the dream of another concept of another law will lead to the establishment of a transnational right to mobility, an attempt to open up a space that the international law of states has not been able to create. The emergence of this subversive right to global mobility, he writes, is an experiment of future law and the future democracy. It is avenir following a chaotic path, and this chaotic path is inseparable from the confusion afflicting the axioms of our international law in a long drawn out process. The subversive potential of these transnational lawmaking processes from below, which Derrida has in mind, is still underestimated. But this counter-hegemonic movement that dissociates law from the state in order to establish a law of world society from below is itself not without potential for violence. Civil society, this is why Antonio Gramsci described it as the state in an extended sense, itself partakes of violence. Even forms of protest, like the exercise of public opinion in escraches and the like, can include violent sanctioning elements. In order to depotentize legal violence, it's not enough to simply replace the international paradigm with a transnational paradigm of law. One cannot escape the violence of law by simply dissociating law from the coercive means of enforcement of the nation state. The potential for violence of law is more fundamental and more comprehensive. Law justifies, distributes, limits political competences, economic assets, technical capabilities, and so forth. Law constitutes forms of public and private violence. The law and its primitive instruments stabilize a variety of social relations of violence. The lines of domination in world society do not run between nation states alone. Racial, gender, economic, religious, etc. discriminations and dominations intersect, overlap, and specifically through their systemic reinforcements lead to fundamental exclusions. This variety of forms of violence stabilized by law cannot be traced back in a one-dimensional way to politics. In other words, the violence of law is not exhausted by the violence of the state. Law remains violent even where it is not state law. Only by detaching the concept of law from state power do the phenomena of violence in world society become visible that cannot be grasped in terms of categories of political unity, implementation backed up by coercion and collective community of citizens. For the polytheism of social deities comprising the economy, politics, law, religion, and science described by Max Weber also constitutes ongoing foundations of violence. These social systems inscribe themselves in law. The law is the continuation of political, economic, technological, military, etc. violence, but with legal means. In the language of law, the programs of law, the code of law. Law is autonomous in a relational sense from these systems. It is interwoven with them, but is itself an outpolitic social system. It is law that produces the lines of inclusion and exclusion for citizenship, and it is also the law that drives people into illegality and in the flight across the Mediterranean into their deaths. It is also law that enables world sports to have its victory arenas in Qatar, erected with slave labor. It is legally underpinned austerity policy that has led to more than threefold increase in suicide rates in Greece since the outbreak of the crisis. Law is deeply implicated in all these tragedies. The co-evolution of law and sports, law and economics, law and politics, law and health, and so forth, in each case gives rise to specific threats to human freedom. The threats to human rights posed by transnational companies make abundantly clear that it would be mistaken to localize the potential for violence with state actors alone. Environmental pollution in the Niger Delta by Shell, the cloven market in articles produced by child labor, private military companies like Blackwater, privatized forms of the exercise of violence are omnipresent. The development of an obligation on private entities to respect human rights is a reaction to these striking forms of violence. Here, the decentering of violence in the transnational constellation calls for a new concept of law that overcomes status reductionism, and in doing so, responds to the transnational phenomena of violence. Unfettered partial rationalities inscribe themselves in law. Transnational companies operate on the global markets on the basis of worldwide contracts. They have developed subtle techniques to make the law serviceable and have created a world in their own image. Judicial forums have been installed in the World Trade Organization and the World Bank, in which the right of free trade and the right of private investors are enforced by courts. The global trend towards legal codification, which has given rise to over 100 new judicial institutions throughout the world, has a strong bias. The institutions of transnational law are chiefly devoted to protecting property rights, investor rights, and the law regulating global trade. The various sectors of world society are obviously undergoing a non-simultaneous process of juridification, and it is striking that social and environmental rights are only equipped with inadequate judicial remedies. As a result, they are already at a structural disadvantage. And this is the precise point of application of counter-hegemonic impulses that seek to transform this socio-structural constellation. The call for global social rights, for example, fights for a transnational legal policy that accords priority to aspects of social and environmental justice and sounds out how to use the potentials of world society to implement alternatives to the existing socio-economic conditions. But these counter-hegemonic impulses have a hard time gaining traction. So naivety is misplaced. The violent permeation of law goes hand in hand with the legal pluralism of world society. No legal order is exempted. Transnational law, supranational law, international law, national law, local law, religious law, etc. Lawmaking in world society remains trapped in the scheme of violence. The transnationalization of law does not lead itself to a non-violent legal system. A further step is needed if one wants to curb legal violence. This second step of legal critique is the commemoration of legal violence. Critique of law must put an end to the lies of camouflage. Law is not the supreme form of rationality, but, to speak with Adorno, as the archetypal phenomenon of irrational rationality, it always has the potential for violence. Reflecting on this violent potential is a precondition for law becoming less guilty. Adorno attributes an expiatory potential to such a reflection on violence. In this connection, Adorno appeals to Nietzsche's critique of morality. Nietzsche, according to Adorno, failed to recognize that the slave morality he criticized so sharply is actually the master morality, namely the morality imposed on the oppressed by the rulers. But in the brutality of Nietzschean moral philosophy, there resides the true insight that, as Adorno puts it, I quote, that in a society that is intrinsically based on violence and exploitation, an avowed violence that looks itself in the face and hence is, if you like, expiatory, is more innocent than one that rationalizes itself as the good. One can read Adorno here as asserting that guilt will never become innocence, only less guilty. It is impossible to dissolve the moment of violence in the capitalist system, but an effort of reflection can have the effect of mitigating guilt. The prerequisite, however, is to make an end to all mendacity. The law must subject its pathological ignorance of violence. It must acknowledge its own tragic character. The tragic irony of legal practice is that legal rationality, which is geared to success by itself, brings forth its failure, its legal violence, and misfortune. Thus, Walter Benjamin also demands that law should acknowledge its violence. If law holds up the mirror of tragedy to itself, if law conceives of itself as tragedy, then expiation is possible. In order to do this, law must achieve the level of reflection of tragedy because, according to Benjamin, it was not in law but in tragedy that the head of the genius first emerged above the cloud of guilt, for in tragedy the hold of demonic fate is broken. If law recognizes its tragic situatedness, something new can arise and emancipation becomes more conceivable. So let us confront law now with its own tragedy, and nothing better seems to be suited for me than Sophocles' Ajax for this purpose. Sophocles recounts the fate of Ajax, a trusted comrade in arms of Achilles, who fell in the Trojan War. It's a legal decision-making violence that strikes down Ajax and drives him first to madness and then to suicide. This neoclassic painting here by Henri Sauveur, painted 1820, shows Ajax desperately blaming demonic powers for his misfortune short before killing himself. And Sophocles' tragedy brings the violent potential of law to light. It visualizes the invisible, shows unsparingly the suffering caused by the law itself. Ajax personifies this suffering. He becomes the victim of a miscarriage of justice that dishonors him by not awarding him the weapons of Achilles from the Battle of Troia. The case is hard to understand, and it's not our business, but it's a wrong decision. This is the point in this tragedy. The madness of Ajax is a consequence of this wrong judicial decision. Judgment, as Deleuze describes the scene, I quote, burst in on the world in the form of the false judgment leading to delirium and madness, when the form imposes an utter lot. Sophocles, as Nietzsche puts it graphically, did not structure the tragedy as a play about guilt and innocence, but writes of the adventure of life that speaks of a restless and vigorous age, an age which is almost intoxicated by its superabundance of blood and energy. Sophocles does not make a judicial verification of the question of guilt the center of the play, but instead madness with and through law. The collision between mythical law and subjectivity, of which Adorno writes in Aesthetic Theory, is fateful for Ajax. Sophocles presents us with a reflection on the violence of law in the form of a tragedy whose explosive force does not simply reside in the fact that positive law stands opposed to natural law. The situation for law is far more dramatic. The logos of law as such becomes problematic in the tragedy. The discourse of tragedy, which is an aesthetic discourse, suspended the legal discourse. The tragic suicide of Ajax, his farewell speech in which he accepts his fate, invalidates the demonic law itself. Ajax's death is a salvation from the insanity of the law. Benjamin describes this moment in his book on the origin of the German tragic drama as the crisis of death, Todeskrisis. He writes, the tragic death has a dual significance. It invalidates the ancient rites of the Olympians, and it offers up the hero to the unknown god as the first fruits of a new harvest of humanity. Death thereby becomes salvation, the crisis of death. Ajax escapes the consequences of legal injustice by committing suicide. His suicide confronts the law, confronts us with the violence of law. Only when we reflect on this violence is expiation possible. The tragedy of law is that it is never pure rationality, that its failure is part of its success because the irrational is inscribed in the form of law. Law always and irrevocably has the potential for violence. It drives people to their death, to despair and hopelessness. Only when law conceives of itself as irrational rationality and acknowledges this potential for violence, it becomes less guilty. As the violence as such cannot be overcome, we have to find new paths to establish a unity of opposites, as Heraclit puts it. How, and this is Nietzsche's questions, can we create a new dialectic of Dionysian and Apollonian Kunsttriebe, artistic impulses, he writes, to facilitate the coincidencia oppositorum? Thus, dissociation and commemoration of legal violences is not enough. A third step of legal critique is needed, a transformation of violence to force. Law must discharge human and social forces and develop a sense for this other of rationality in the form of law. To break the silence and set social relations dancing, law has to release social and human forces as the other of legal violence. Until now, law has placed its relation to force under a taboo. It has, as Jacques Derrida puts it in his critique of structuralism, stifled force under form and reduced law to a medium for transferring meaning. Law, like classical moral philosophy, understands itself from the standpoint of the legal moral economic political subject. As a result, law situates itself in the interplay between reason and emotion on the side of reason or the rationality of social relations alone. Law is blind to the other of reason. Law does not maintain any correspondence with the manifestations of force, with feelings, energies, drives, and all the neediness of human life. Law has closed itself off from emotionality. Law defines itself up to the present day as the embodiment of rationality, reason, and objectivity. That fails to recognize the connection between force and law. Law is not subsumed by nonviolent interaction between legal subjects who recognize each other as equals. The law constitutes the legal subjects who constitute the law. In the beginning is a tautology. The signature invents the signer. The legal subject invents the law. This mythical founding of law is the result of an unfolding of force. This unfolding of force proceeds from people of flesh and blood and not from legal systems. It finds expression in forms of interaction that are not just conscious actions but also unconscious doing. Law must develop receptiveness to these forces, to the cry that expresses pain, the tears in the courtroom that communicate suffering. Irrationality as energy, emotion, instinct, tribes is part of the law. Like the social commodity that embodies individual labor power, individual force is also transformed into law through a real abstraction. The force of law does not proceed from the subject but from people of flesh and blood. The normativity of law does not spring from a rational conviction in the law but from the simultaneity of the rationality and the irrationality of law. Force is not expressed in the consensus of reason but in the disagreement of hearts. Only the inclusion of the irrational opens our eyes to the forms of interaction that style themselves against the social consensus of the unconscious. If law is to do justice to life, it must not be reduced to a context of intersubjective relations. Law is irrational rationality and rational irrationality. Force is not something alien to the law. Law is affected by force. Law itself is a force field, as Pierre Bourdieu puts it. Already the digests recognize the interplay between law and force. Scire legis, non hoc est verba, earum tenere sed vim ac potestate. To know the law is, however, not only is not understanding the words, but their force and effect. Derrida's deconstructivist question also follows Walter Benjamin in taking the force of law as its point of departure and seeks to divorce it from legal violence. How, writes Jacques Derrida in Force of Law, I quote, are we to distinguish between this force of the law and the violence that one always deems unjust? What difference is there between, on the one hand, the force that can be just or in any case deemed legitimate, and on the other hand, the violence that one always deems unjust? What is just force or a non-violent force? But Derrida does not go on to develop the concept of force further. He does not connect the force of law with his own analysis of force and structure. Thus, social relations of force and the aesthetics of human force, such as that presented by Christoph Menke, remain unconnected. Precisely here, however, in the combination of social and human forces resides an untapped potential for a critique of law. Such a critique would have to be required to develop a receptiveness to the human and social forces. By aesthetically reflecting on its own forces, law could develop a sense for when the force of law becomes inverted into violence, or when law overwhelms human forces and violently impedes them in their development. Might is right to quote Friedrich Schiller's Denunciation and the Robbers, and the limits of our forces are our laws. If law is to be able to recognize the contribution of legal form to the violent subjugation of this force, it must come to see the connection between legal force and human force. Only in this way can law oppose the violent mechanisms that, to quote Schiller again, cramp the flight of eagles to a snail's pace in the name of the law. In order to be able to understand and modify the mechanism with which law suppresses force, law must become responsive to force. Only when law releases the human and social forces and builds upon them, does the force of law have a chance. Adorno recognized this challenge of linking irrationality and rationality. He connected them in the concept of mimesis, through which autonomous social forms open themselves to force. This becomes especially apparent in his writings on music theory. Thus, in a work on Alban Berg, he demands that one must restore human rights to banished heretical yearning. And on Arnold Schoenberg's melodrama A Survivor from Warsaw, in which the anti-Semitic threat is rendered palpable by musical form, Adorno writes, quotation now, "The truly subversive moment for him, for Schoenberg, lies in the change in the function of musical expression. Passions are no longer faked. On the contrary, in disguise corporal influences, leibhafte Regungen, of the unconscious shocks, traumas, are registered in the medium of music. They attack the taboos of the form, because these taboos submit the impulses to their censorship. Real suffering has left them the blood traces behind in the work of art as a sign that it no longer recognizes the autonomy of the work of art." This challenges the modest appearance of autonomy. In the tension between mimesis and rationality, Adorno seeks to inaugurate a process in which mimesis becomes the corrective correlate of rationality. Emancipatory mimesis breaks the primacy of purposive rationality and establishes tension in the system. The impulse, naked physical fear, and the sense of solidarity with what Brecht called tormentable bodies becomes the contradiction inherent in the inhuman system. For Adorno, in the age of universal social repression, the image of freedom against society lives in the features of the oppressed or crushed individual. But what does this mimesis involve? Mimesis for Adorno is precisely not a naive back to nature. Instead, it is a historical process of concrete struggles for freedom. An archaic mimesis that promises the harmonious identity of the non-identical through the imitation of pseudo-natural conditions is not a timely response to the challenges of a differentiated society. There is no prerogative of true natural order over a mimetic double, in the simulacrum, archetype and image become blurred. As soon as the social artifact wants to prompt the illusion of the natural, it founders, writes Adorno. This foundering of naive naturalness is the reason why in aesthetic theory Adorno emphasizes the monadological character of the artwork, which is at once a force field and a thing. Characteristic of emancipatory mimesis, therefore, is not an essentialism of force, but a process of closed openness of autonomous social forms. Adorno is concerned to establish an immanent crystallized process. Emancipatory mimesis aims to frame a subversive process in which the possibility of a reconciled life of the free is inaugurated. In this connection, Adorno attributes, I quote, "those driving forces that erupt volcanically and rebel against the horrible, such as the suffering of others, the force to create a human social life." He assumes that a human social order could be established only if human drives are no longer suppressed, but are instead fulfilled and released. Thus, this constitutes the meaning of emancipatory mimesis. Similarly, Kant, Immanuel Kant, had seen the central task of democracy as residing in enabling human beings and even a people of devils to arrange, I quote, "those forces of nature in opposition to one another in such a way that one checks the destructive effect of the other." Kant looks for democratic forms of organization that lead people, even in the conflict of their unpeaceable dispositions, to bring about a condition of peace in which laws have force. That breaks the fetters of rationality by heightening our awareness of the irrational in social institutions. The social forms are part of an unfolding of force and drives that begins with human beings, only the way of implementing the self-reflexivity of law develops a sense for this, can law help the idea of human and social freedom to exercise social effects. Only then does law take Marx's call for emancipation seriously. In his essay on the Jewish question, he writes, I quote again, "All emancipation is a reduction of the human world and relationships to man himself. Political emancipation is the reduction of man on the one hand to a member of civil society, to an egoistic, independent individual, and on the other hand to a citizen, a moral person. Only when man has recognized and organized his force propre, his own forces as social forces, and consequently no longer separates social forces from himself in the shape of political forces, only then will human emancipation have been accomplished. Therefore, the hope would be, as Marx puts it in his critique of Hegel's philosophy of law, that this reflection on force in law could succeed in forcing these petrified relations to dance by singing their own tune to them. This confrontation of the law with its own tune demands the last step of a critique of law. So critique of law must insist on first, a dissociation of violence, second, a commemoration of violence, third, a transformation of violences, and it must, and this is now my fourth and last and inevitable, necessary, essential step for a critique of law must facilitate the transcendence of violence. Only just, legal, non-violent force transcends legal violence and transcends legal violence. This is a paradoxical demand. In order to supersede legal violence, the impulse of justice demands the other, a rational law, but immediately opposes it, again without embracing legal nihilism. Walter Benjamin recognized this paradox. He does not reduce the critique of law to the misconception of legal nihilism that turns against the law without having a concept of law, but instead seeks to put law on trial with legal means. Benjamin observed this very trait in Karl Kraus, I quote from his essay on Karl Kraus, "To worship the image of divine justice has a language, even in the German language, that is the genuinely Jewish somersault by which he tries to break the spell of the demon. Because this is the last official act of this seyavot, to place the legal system itself under accusation, and not in a petty bourgeois revolt against the enslavement of the free individual by dead formulas, still less in the posture of those radicals who storm paragraphs without ever for a moment having taken counsel of justice. Kraus accuses the law in its substance, not in its effect. His charge is the betrayal of justice by law. The idea of indicting the law for high treason in the name of justice is the distillation of a messianic Marxist trait in Benjamin's work. Benjamin calls for a new form of legality. This new legality can be realized only as the negation of the old legality. It will inaugurate a new order, a post-demonic age that leaves demonic violence in its wake. The angel of history will look back over its debris." Benjamin intimates how this can be realized with reference to Sorel's distinction between the political and the proletarian general strike. Benjamin insists that the political general strike serves as a symbol for a struggle that issues instrumental and strategic action. The proletarian general strike, by contrast, as an expression of the prevailing violence, is the escape from the circle of violence, of calculation and counter-calculation, of success, concession, compromise, struggle, and so on. It is formless and anticipates communism. Benjamin's point is the insistence that the proletarian appropriation of the law does not destroy law. Rather, in the social appropriation of the institutions, the prospect of a transcending of law must be kept open. When Etienne Balibar writes in the Historical Critical Dictionary of Marxism, in response to the relationship between politics and violence, which he describes as tragic, that the civilizing of the revolution must go hand in hand with the civilizing of politics, He articulates the parallel idea that the cycle of violence and counter-violence must be brought to halt. However, in Balibar, this ultimately boils down a player for a politics of non-violence a la Mahatma Gandhi. Balibar banks on politics being civilized through a self-civilizing of civil society. Here, Benjamin's approach is much more radical because it targets both the street and the inner workings of the problematic systems. With law against the law. One must, in Rudolf Wiethoeder's words, put law on trial in order to pacify the system from the inside out, to reinterpret its own resources in an emancipatory way. This ultimately transcends the system itself. The cold sphere of modern legal rationality is confronted with its other, pure justice, like generosity in a profit-led economy, like friendship in real power politics, and like forgiving and moral discourses. The reference to justice in law reactivates in sacralized discourses utopian energies from quite different sources, as Gunther Hoffmann puts it, with Jacques Derrida. It is tempting to dismiss this as a messianic fanaticism, but that would not do justice to the complexity of Benjamin's idea, whose call to overcome demonic law in capitalist society is squarely in the tradition of the Frankfurt School. Benjamin and Adorno were in agreement when it came to overcoming the demonic capitalist system. Both believed that if you take the promise of the demonic system and their word, transcendence in the immanence of this system becomes possible. Where Benjamin wants, referring to Karl Kraus, to put the law on trial in the court of justice, Adorno calls for the fulfillment of the promise of transactional or barter justice in order to put an end to the lie. In Negative Dialectics, he writes, now my last quotation, and then we have finally two quotation of Adorno, yes. If comparability as a category of measure were simply annulled, the rationality inherent in the barter principle as ideology, of course, but also as promise, would give way to direct appropriation, to violence, and nowadays to the naked privilege of monopolies and cliques. When we criticize the barter principle, we want to realize the ideal of free and just barter. To date, this ideal is only a pretext. Its realization alone would transcend barter. The counterpart of this formulation of Adorno is Benjamin's notion that systemic violence must be undermined from within. The critique of the violence of law, to summarize the point one last time, would then have to take law and its promise of justice at its word in order to turn this promise against it. Only the impossible realization of just law can transcend the law. This is not a form of messianic fanaticism, but a realistic utopia of social emancipation. Society is not redeemed, it liberates itself. The task of the critique of law as a critique of the violences of law is to contribute to keeping the spaces of possibility for this human and social emancipation open, to ensure that even in the transnational constellation, the liberation from forms of legal violence remains a veneer. This is not an empty idea, but a task that, gradually solved, comes steadily closer to its goal. Thank you very much.